นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะอะปาริตาเตสังมัตตัสสะดวาระเยสุตวันโตปะมัญจันตุสะธานิ Before the talk this evening, I'd like to ruminate a little bit on a topic we were discussing a couple of days ago indirectly, and which I've been contemplating for the last little while, and that's about the question of the one's growth and development, the spiritual development in different stages of life, and how that manifests in this particular tradition that we've chosen to practice within. One of the things about the Buddhist teachings, of course, within Buddhism, that we have the notion of development is, of course, central to Buddhism. And so the path of Buddhism is not about receiving some kind of revelation from outside or anything like that, but the path is what we do, what we practice every day. And the path comes from, essentially, from within. Of course, it's conditioned and influenced by external influences as well. But the most important source of our ongoing spiritual development happens from within. Now that the way that we talk about practice and development is in Buddhism is usually not specific to any age or culture or gender or anything like that. So we talk about developing kindness and compassion, or developing mindfulness, practicing sila, ethics, and so on. And all of these things are, for the most part, applicable to everyone. It's a general teaching. And one of the characteristics that you notice in Buddhist teachings is that certainly the way that I was brought up, that most of the teachings are given in an environment like this, where we have different people of different ages, different backgrounds, different personalities, who nevertheless, for some strange reason, possibly the whimsy of fate, karma or whatever, have ended up here in the same room together and listening to the same teachings. And so for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part, we have this kind of social or sort of generalized teaching on development and practice, and it's up to each individual to work out for themselves where they kind of fit in to that. And of course that's not always easy to work out. And you can compare that model, say, with the model of therapy or something, where it's much more based on an individual relationship, one-to-one, and sort of communication or development of particular means that are useful for a particular individual. It's not to say there's no individual teachings in Buddhism, of course there are, but mostly it tends to be on that general level. So for that reason, then I think it's valid to talk about a sort of a generalized or culture of development. It's something that's, you know, the development of a sangha, of a group of people, in a general sense, within which each individual will situate themselves in one way or another. And my thinking about this has been, was sparked by reading some essays of Jung over the weekend. And as you may know, one of the special emphases that Carl Jung brought to psychology was looking at the different challenges faced by people at different stages of their life. Whereas Jung's teacher Freud focused, of course, very famously on the events of infancy and early childhood as being formative of the various kinds of neuroses and difficulties that we have in later life. For Jung, this was only one part of the story, and he thought that at each stage of the life we faced new and different challenges, and our psychological health was a factor not just of, couldn't be, not all of our problems and issues could be traced to our childhood, but also to the way that we handled the challenges of adulthood and later of middle age and growing old and so on. And so he sort of developed this psychology over that length of time. And this is quite interesting for me personally because I became, like many people, came to the Dhamma when I was in my 20s and joined the Sangha in my mid-20s. And so since now I'm in my 40s, and so in middle age, so I'm approaching in another phase of my life. So for me, there's been many changes in my practice and what I'm doing and so on. So this is partly a personal reflection, but also a reflection on the nature of the teachings and so on as a whole. One of the caveats, I might say, right at the beginning, is that the Jung's book that I was reading, where I came across these reflections, this book's called Aspects of the Masculine and Aspects of the Feminine. So he's looking at these things. It's a selection of passages from various places in Jung's writing. And so he's looking at it from different gender angles. And the first part of it, Aspects of the Masculine, is where I got these particular, train of thought was sparked. So forgive me for focusing mostly on masculine development, of course, being, you know, obviously what I know better, and also the environment that I grew up in a male monastic community. But I'll try to reflect on what that might mean in terms of women's development as well, but masculine development will be the main focus to start with anyway. So the particular thought or line that Jung said that really struck me was something that along the lines of that in middle age or approaching middle age, one has to let go of the hero. And I found that a very personal, very, very powerful statement, and one which I think is very telling in terms of the nature of the spiritual development. So to understand that, we have to understand a little bit about what the hero means what we're letting go of. So essentially the hero in Jungian psychology is the individual or the self, the person who triumphs over obstacles and achieves that treasure that's hard to win. Now the obstacle that one triumphs over may of course be anything. It's just the difficulties of life, so anything can be that, but it's often symbolized as the dragon, and so the hero is one who vanquishes the dragon, and where the dragon is a very kind of polyvalent symbol, can mean anything pretty much, but it's at least on the surface, at its deepest meaning, it means knowledge of oneself, awakening to one's own nature. Is always what the inner meaning of overcoming these obstacles and winning the treasure that's hard to gain. And so that's really the treasure that's hard to gain, is understanding of one's own nature. But of course in particular personal narratives or in myths and so on, it's often represented in many different forms. Now it's interesting that this notion that the dragon is the obstacle, the obstacles in one's psychological or spiritual development, is not just something which is an invention of 20th century psychology, but actually in the Indic sphere is actually encoded in the etymology of the words we use in Buddhism. And one of the most well-known words in Buddhist psychology is the word nivarana, meaning a hindrance. And we all know about the five hindrances to meditation, but the word nivarana is actually from the same root as the word which in the Vedas is vritra, and vritra is the serpent or the dragon who's overcome by Indra in the dragon fight. And so this vritra or nivarana is the hindrances, whatever has to be overcome in one's own spiritual quest. And so these ideas, this is why I find these ideas quite fascinating, because even though Buddhism tends to express things in a psychological sense, but underneath it, underneath those teachings, these resonances and images are still powerful and still present. So the basic idea is that at each stage of life we have a dragon, we have some difficulty, some problem, some obstacle that must be overcome in order for us to win the treasure that's hard to gain, whatever that treasure is at different stages of life. And of course this is not something which, you know, like in the fairy stories where you win, you know, beat the dragon, win the treasure and then live happily ever after. You know, it's just a narrative convention. In real life, of course, it's an ongoing struggle. There's no one particular time that it happens or doesn't happen and so on. It's something that keeps evolving and keeps changing. It may well be more intense at certain times than others, but it's something which is ongoing every all the time, every day. So as I was thinking about this, I was reflecting, well, what's the nature of the hero's quest at that time, in that place? So the structure of the hero's story is always the same. The hero goes out, fights the battle, wins the prize, and then returns and integrates that. That structure is always the same, but the details of it will differ according to context. For some people, and sometimes it may be a relatively shallow thing, it may be just a material thing, and for others it's a deeply spiritual quest. And so this is why we find that the life story of the Buddha is told in the structure of the hero myth, and being a story of a profound quest for spiritual awakening. And the structure of the story is more or less the same as even quite trivial fairy tales. And so on. So if you look at something like The Hobbit or something like that, it's basically the same structure, narrative structure, as the Buddha's mythology, Buddha's life story. So the patterns are always the same. The patterns are playing themselves out in similar ways, but the content of those patterns is different in many different cases. So what's the content of that heroic quest for myself and for young monks who come along to a monastery, and young men who come along and want to practice Dhamma in that way? And when I was reflecting on this, it seemed to me that there were two particular things that were characteristic of that teaching that I experienced, and which I think are characteristic of the forest tradition or the Wat Pa Pong tradition or whatever it may be. And those two things are, one is related to the body, and that's the overcoming of desire. And the other one is relating to the mind, and that's the overcoming of views, attachment to views. Of course, I don't want to be reductive about this. I'm not trying to say that this is all that's being taught. I'm just trying to say that these are things which are characteristic and emphasized at that time. And in that context, there are obviously many other things emphasized which all play their part. But these things, if you know, in those teachings which you find, and certainly that I encounter, these things are mentioned and emphasized very strongly. Now, these particular teachings have, or particular dhammas, have a context, and they have a meaning. And one of the characteristics of the hero's quest is that the hero, in a sense, draws to himself the adversaries who are appropriate for his own nature and his own needs. So the quest, in a way, that the quest that the hero undertakes is, it seems to be something that's out there lying in the landscape, is in fact something which the hero needs to do for his own personal reasons. And so the same thing, even though within that tradition that I ordained in, that these things seem to be sort of objectively living there in the landscape out there, they're written in the books, they're talked about in the Dhamma talks and so on, but the reason why particular individuals end up in that particular context, and why I ended up in that context, is because in some way these things resonate, in some way there's a connection, there's a need, they fulfill some kind of need. They speak to the particular kinds of dragons which need to be overcome at that time. Now, when I was at Dhanachat and in the kind of monasteries there, you know, I was pretty much a typical, in many ways demographically, fairly typical person. You know, I was 26, 27, male, white from a Western background, educated, and so on, with a kind of artistic temperament and these kinds of things. And that's more or less pretty typical. And so, for looking back on myself at that time, and for others around the same time, then there are particular characteristics that we have that these teachings are meeting. And of course, at that time, one's in the mid 20s, one's in the prime of one's physical strength. The kind of your body is at its strongest and most capable. We're sort of grown out of the awkwardness of adolescence, but not yet experienced the decline of middle age. And at that time, we also haven't really experienced the aging of the body, the inevitable decline of the body. You've still got a feeling that when things break or things go wrong, or if you get sick, that they're going to get better, and that things will go along more or less as they have been, rather than feeling like, well, it's not always going to get better, and if it does get better, it's not going to be 100%. And so that's at that kind of height of identification with one's physical prowess. And of course that expresses itself in sexuality and various other kinds of behaviours typically at that time. So normally what we would think is, for most men at that time, what the dragon fight is to restrain and channel and mature that kind of physical energy in a responsible and adult way. Typically, for example, by getting married, by entering into a mature and committed relationship and using your physical strength not just for your own enjoyment and pleasure, but also for helping to raise a family and taking that responsibility of a job and all of those kinds of things. So that's a kind of fairly normal way that that juncture would be negotiated. So of course for monastics it's a bit more drastic, and so we undertake the vows of celibacy and various other means of restraining and containing the body and its energies through eating once or twice a day, reducing our sleep, reducing the comfort and luxury of one's surroundings, and so on and so forth. And certainly when I was in Thailand, it was pretty tough. Physically, there was a lot to endure. There was a lot of different kinds of pain, and one had to kind of master this kind of ascetic sort of tapas, or kind of burning energy that can make one endure through sitting in long periods through pain and enduring the weather and the various kinds of challenges which you're faced with fairly regularly in that kind of environment. And through that, and through that practice, then no doubt it brings up a genuine kind of joy and a genuine feeling of accomplishment, because that's something that really needs to be done at that time. You really genuinely are overcoming this attachment to the body and intoxication with your body, and getting a sense of understanding of distance and so on, where you're not at the sort of running round at the whims of your body, and because you have a desire to go off and eat this, or a desire to go off and have sex, or a desire to go off and smoke some dope or something like that, you just don't do it. And so this kind of restraining, and then that gives a great sense of power and energy to the mind that one's able to do that. And so this is where a lot of the joy and emotional satisfaction comes from. So this is on the physical side, and on the intellectual side we have the detachment from views. And again, this relates, I think, to a specific developmental stage, especially I think for young men. Certainly my experience is that that when you reach adolescence, 14, 15, 16 years old, that you learn how to think, you learn how to reason. And I'm sure many of us know, young men or women of that age, you get very opinionated and very full of themselves, and you think that you can work everything out according to reason. I certainly know that I did, and you really think that everybody else is irrational and become quite a bit kind of contemptuous of other people and even your parents or others, because they can't see that this is something is so rational. It seems so reasonable to, for example, not believe in God anymore. So when I was that age, I decided I didn't believe in God for various kinds of rational reasons that I kind of worked out in my head, which I still think are perfectly valid rational reasons. But of course, the thing is that it's not that your parents are stupid or that older people who do believe in God are stupid, but it's just that they see things in life that are not just reason, not just rationality, and that there are purposes and roles that these things play. But at that time, that there's this intoxication with logic, an intoxication with the power of one's mind to think, to analyze, and to work things out, and you think that you can master the universe by doing this through the power of science and deduction and all of these things. So when we come along to the monastery, and again, not completely in a way that's not completely unprecedented, but in a way which in some ways also is responding to a call within oneself, that oneself realizes the limitations of this attitude. And so responding to that, and then you get this teaching of, oh, let go of your thoughts, don't think so much. And so this thing in which we've taken so much pride, in which we've rejoiced and exalted, in which we think this faculty of thought which we believed would lead us to the truth, and suddenly we realize that actually this is not so reliable after all, it's not so useful, that one's views are contingent, that they're unreliable. And as the Chanki Sutta we read yesterday puts it, that you know, think views accepted after pondering them can turn out to be either true or false. And so again, this is part of the process of maturation. It's what happens to everyone, goes through this development, or at least they should do. But again, is not merely like in a normal process of development, then it might be more to simply understanding the relativity of views and that other people have other opinions which are perfectly valid and so on. So we have a more kind of open mind in that way. Whereas in the monastery and in this tradition, we're told to let go of all views whatsoever and to literally not think, to literally have a completely empty mind which doesn't have any views or any opinions. And so this is quite a drastic step of non-identification with one's views and opinions, which parallels the equally drastic step of disidentifying with your body and its urges, which is also happening at the same time. So these two practices, I believe, are very powerful, and I know from my own experience are very powerful and very have a very significant effect on the course of one's development and how one's changes, how one's mind and spiritual development changes over time. And it's not just a short-term thing. It's not just something you do at one time and then, you know, and then get over it. But it's a structural shift. It's a shift in the whole way of being. Now, even though I've been talking about this and as being in a way typical of certainly my experience and the experience which is fairly common in certainly say a community like what Nana Child or something when I was a young monk, but still obviously it doesn't apply to everyone, and like everything, this development has its shadow. And it seems to me that the shadow of this, or at least one aspect of the shadow which needs to be considered, is that rather than being called to that adventure or that particular dragon fight because it meets one's actual needs, one's called to it despite the fact, almost like in a perverse way, even though it's in some ways is exactly the opposite of what one needs. So of course there are some young men who come along to the monastery who are not infatuated and intoxicated with their bodies, but they may have in fact various quite severe issues regarding their bodies. They may have a lot of confusion regarding their sexuality. They may have confusion or issues relating to women, for example. And so then those teachings then take on is precisely the wrong teaching for that person. Or again, somebody may not have learned how to think, and someone doesn't know how to have their own opinions. They don't know how to reason, and they don't know how to express or to argue their opinions. And so to tell somebody like that you shouldn't have any thoughts, you shouldn't have any views, is exactly the wrong medicine. Then they'll never learn how to form an intelligent or reflective view or opinion. So in some ways, this teaching, this kind of general teaching, can easily, and certainly I think does have its shadow side in terms of how development proceeds. And it also has a lack, and I think one of the great lacks of it is the lack of the awareness of the feminine. And it tends to be a fairly masculine environment and masculine teaching. And in a way, the feminine, or the integration of the feminine in that, is, or should be, in terms of, for example, the development of those qualities of loving kindness and compassion and so on. But those kinds of compassions are not emphasized very much, and in fact are sometimes actively denigrated. I've heard monks say, for example, that metta monks have babies. Right? This is one saying that I heard. If you do metta, then you'll end up having babies. So this, you know, give you the kind of idea that there's a fear around these softer emotions, and sometimes kind of lip service is paid to them, but they're certainly not developed and emphasized in the same way that the other things that I've been talking about have been. And so there's this kind of problem around the feminine. Of course, the development of the body in particular, as I mentioned before, one's letting go of one's attachment to one's own body and so on, is very closely related to one's sexual desire, typically for women. And so there's that strong post aspect of rejection of the feminine, which is not necessarily countered by a positive and balanced acceptance of the higher aspects of the feminine, what Jung calls the anima, is the spiritual counterpart of the feminine in the mind of the man. So this is, I think, one problem, and I think that there's also another potential problem, which it seems to me for women in particular when coming into this environment, is that again, I'm just kind of speculating here, and you can probably all correct me afterwards, but it would seem to me that would be often the case for women, that their problems would be exactly the opposite of the case for the young men. And so rather than being infatuated by one's body and its capabilities, often women are very ashamed by their bodies and have a feeling that their bodies are inadequate, all the kind of problems around their anorexia and all of these kinds of things, which are very well documented in monastic settings, such that the history of anorexia is, and then eating disorders, is very largely actually the history of nuns and of the problems that nuns have had. If you research the actual documentation on eating disorders, most of the documentation in historical times is actually the experience of nuns, in the Western sphere anyway. So I think that there's first of all this kind of problem, which comes from the objectification of the women's bodies, images of sort of overly perfect images of women's bodies in the media and all of this kind of thing, which cause I think a lot of women to have these problems of feeling inadequate or not measuring up and so on. So this is one side, and then with regard to the intellectual side of the views is, I think, again, a lot of the problem typically is not so much that one's too opinionated and so on, but that one can't find one's voice. And this is something that's been identified very often by the feminist psychologists, is that even today, girls and in school find it difficult to have their voice heard, to actually articulate what they're saying, to actually formulate their views and have them taken seriously in a male-dominated world. And so, again, the problem not being so much that one is, you know, too opinionated and dogmatic and attached to one's views, but more that one hasn't yet learned how to have the confidence to be able to form and articulate one's views and have them taken seriously. So, and it strikes me as being somewhat curious that this is almost the opposite of the masculine emphasis, but being the opposite of the normal masculine emphasis is more or less similar to what I mentioned before as the shadow side of the men's experience in the monastery and in this kind of environment. So the shadow side of the masculine is, I think, similar to what perhaps is the dominant or the more straightforward side in the feminine experience in that environment. And so for this reason, the feminine and the women are, I think, quite in a literal way, embodying or carrying the shadow of the monks and carrying the shadow of the men. And this is certainly how it's been described to me, as being how it's been experienced by nuns and by women living in these environments. So they felt that they had to carry the burden of the shadow of the monks in many ways. So if we sort of, again, I can only paint a very simplistic picture at this time, but if we come from there and sort of skip forward a generation to, say, my age now, and you know, been hanging around monasteries for roughly 20 years and so on, and I've gone from that phase of entering adulthood now to the phase of entering middle age. And so then there's the question of letting go, coming back to this idea that Jung said of letting go of the hero, letting go of the hero's achievements. Now Jung illustrates this with a very beautiful image of the course of the sun. And he said that life is... he used this very beautiful image, which he himself said was... the word he used to describe it was lame. But I think actually it's very beautiful. Not lame at all. But he said that life is like the sun, which emerges from the ocean in the morning time. Like the infant is emerging from the unconscious and gradually mounts up into the sky. And as it mounts up into the sky, is illuminates more and more of the land and shines brighter and brighter until eventually it reaches the zenith. And from that time, which of course is zenith being around the middle of one's life, and from that time one's essential vista changes. Instead of looking upwards to a growth and becoming more brilliant and more conscious, one's looking, in a sense, forward to the unconscious, in a way mirroring the journey that one's had in the first part of life, but mirroring it in quite a different way. Twilight, as one descends once again into the darkness, the twilight of the evening is quite different from the twilight of the morning, and the twilight of the morning holds promise, the twilight of the evening holds memory and experience and wisdom. So While the general principles and so on at work are still the same at that time in life, but the particular way that one applies them may be quite different. And so within a Buddhist context, all of the things that we've been doing are just the same. Practice of the Eightfold Path is just the same. Meditation is just the same. Studying the Dhamma, discussing it, and developing wholesome qualities of mind and developing one's sila and all of these kinds of things, they all stay the same. The essentials of the Buddhist practice, they don't change. They're the context within this development is happening. But the specific emphasis and particular qualities that one wants to develop at that stage need to change, and they need to be appropriate for that particular context. And so it's kind of reflecting on this and reflecting, well, what is going on? In what way does one let go of those heroic conquests of one's youth? And then I'm thinking, well, again, taking up those two aspects, which seem to me to be quite prominent within the particular context of the forest tradition that I ordained in, then the letting go of the desire for one's body sort of now moves into another phase. I'm no longer at the sort of the peak of strength and health of the body, but now in a period where you're sort of starting to see the aging of the body, starting to see the breaking up of the body, as the Buddha said, the breaking up of the teeth. I can certainly feel that very well, having had a lot of dental work in my life. The greying of the hair, starting to see the hair turning grey, wrinkling of the skin starting to show up a little bit, and so on. So you're seeing these processes, you're realizing that the strength of the body is more or less going to be diminishing each year, and one's resistance to illness is going to be diminishing, one's ability to recover from injury is diminishing year by year, and that one's physical course of life is now that sort of gradual movement towards the grave and towards death. And so this is something which, whereas before was sort of done as an abstract contemplation, which you try to apply in the context of a body in which this is not really happening. Yeah? So when you're young and you contemplate about aging and death and so on in meditation, well, it's not something you can actually literally see. Whereas now, for me, it's the actual reality. It's not something I have to try to bring about. It's merely something I have to bring awareness to inside my own body. And so that this changes one's relationship to the various desires and all of these kinds of things. It doesn't mean that they're not there, and it doesn't mean that the same battles are not being fought. But, you know, it's a very different perspective in relation to, say, sexuality, in relationship to eating and all of these kinds of things. So that has a very different kind of way of looking at them. So similarly with regards to... what I should say then, to come back to that, is that the essential difference in the task is that whereas for a young person there needs to be a disidentification from the body because the tendency is to intoxication, whereas for somebody who's aging, then the task that's required is not disidentification, but the task that's required is acceptance. And because the natural emotional reaction is despair, yeah, or denial. And so we start to try to cover things up. We want to, you know, have plastic surgery or whatever, inject a bit of Botox or something like that to try to hide the aging process. So we go into this mode of denial and trying to recapture youth. So that the essential emotional attitude that we need is acceptance rather than the earlier stage where what we needed was disidentification. And with regards to the mind or the views that one has, then again it seems to me that there's a shift in what's really required for somebody at that stage, the young stage of life. What they need is to have the ability to let go of one's own thoughts or views or ideas, to have a reasonable and relative perspective on the things that reason and logic can and can't do, and so on, and to be able to find the quietness of the mind through meditation. But for someone in middle age, or someone in my position, what we need to do is something quite different, and that's what we need to do is to learn to take responsibility for our decisions. And again, of course, it's something everyone needs to do. Everyone needs to learn that. But particularly, as you know, approaching this time of life, we put in positions of responsibility. We have to act in a way that's mature and balanced and so on. It can't be so impulsive and opinionated or whatever. And so that requires actual thinking. It requires actual reflection. It requires not letting go and relativizing all one's views, but it requires having opinions and being able to reflect on them, to discuss them, and to put them into to practice, and to express them and so on in various ways. So in many ways is actually quite a different, almost the opposite, skills that need to be learnt at that stage in one's life. And I think that these are things which certainly I've never, in my experience, have never been really taught within my tradition. You know, we've never been taught how do you make decisions, how about the kind of a mature process of reflection and learning how to make decisions. And so that to me is a process, an ongoing process, which is my experience in these years. And perhaps, you know, for some of you, of course, people here are of all different ages, so for some of you this is already old news and you've already been through this many years ago and have your own challenges, and for others this is something that maybe lies in the future, and so it's something you can reflect about now but will become more important to you much later on. But I just want to come back to why, again, the shadow side of these things and where these things can go wrong sometimes. And one of the critical things that's happening at each of these stages is that we're forming a sense of identity. We're forming a self, not in a bad way, but just forming in a sense of having a coherent sense of who we are, what we're doing here, a sense of meaning, a sense of being able to integrate one's emotions and mind and so on in a healthy way, and to be able to accomplish what one needs to accomplish, and so on and so forth. Now, when we come to the monastery, and again, it's a bit difficult to generalize, but often, certain, by no means all the time, but often one comes to the monastery because one doesn't know who one is. And very often we embark on the spiritual quest because we're confused, we're lost, we're adrift on the ocean. And like Ulysses, who lost all of his ships, all of his men, and eventually was just cast adrift in the middle of the ocean with nothing but a piece of driftwood to cling to in the storm. And so this is, and then we see the island, you know, the Dhamma or the Sangha or the monastery or the practice or whatever it is something that we can invest in, we can get excited about, enthusiastic about, passionate about, we can commit to. And so we can, then that becomes a structure that allows our sense of self, our sense of identity to form at that particular stage. And so we have a healthy process, a good process of ego formation, which allows us to then develop appropriately from there on. And that's, of course, a very good thing. But the problem with that and the shadow with that is that if that experience can sometimes be so powerful and so overwhelming that it's very hard to let go of. And again, to come back to this idea that Jung said that one should let go of the hero, the more drastic the hero's quest is, the more it defines one's life and the more it's hard to get over it. You know, and just to think about that, to move out of the mythical and into the realm of everyday life, you know, you think about it today, overcoming the hero's quest, many of us may be something like, say, going to university, getting a degree, for example. Okay, so this is a heroic quest. It's a task, it's difficult to do. We apply ourselves with energy, overcome the obstacles, and we win that prize it's hard to win, getting a degree. And but what about somebody else? Let's say somebody else for who the heroic quest is, say, going to war. As somebody joins the army, they end up getting sent to Iraq. And for them, their heroic quest is far more intense. They're overcoming the fear, all of the emotions and the intentions and all the ethical problems and so on, which are thrown upon a young men and women who are not really very adequately equipped to deal with it in many cases. And so that in a sense, that kind of drastic shift, then when one returns, is then of course much harder to integrate, and you can often find that people even much later in their life still really strongly identify with those experiences of war, because it was such a drastic step in the formation of their own ego. And so the same thing can happen in monastic life, where you come from a relatively undeveloped sense of ego, a sense of being lost and so on, to actually or coming to the monastery, ordaining, you're so strongly reinforced by everyone around you. The culture is putting you literally on a pedestal. You've been literally being worshipped by so many people. We've been, you know, maybe suffering from low self-esteem, maybe feeling hopeless, lost, I can't accomplish anything. And then all of a sudden here you are literally being worshipped by all of these people who you don't even know, who come in and bow and prostrate themselves on the floor in front of you. And so there's this very kind of strong sense of ego. Again, not meaning this in a bad sense. I'm just meaning that one can construct a very healthy sense of self. But the problem is then, if one is not able to overcome that in later life, if one's not able to let go of the hero's quest. And to me, the signifier of this is the classic phrase, which I've already dropped once or twice in this talk, which is, "When I was a young monk." And that's for those of you who are Monty Python fans, we'll get the reference to the four Yorkshiremen, which is a similar kind of psychological situation. And so when we get older as monks, we're continually referring back to those experiences that we had as young monks. In other words, we're remembering how our ego, our sense of self, was formed through winning the dragon fight at that time, through overcoming those obstacles and winning those prizes, which were indeed precious and good things to win, and triumphing over the dragon was a genuine heroic quest. And that's not the problem. The problem is that at a later stage in life, we're not able to let go of that. We're not able to see what is the dragon that's in front of us right now. What are the obstacles that we need to address here and now? How do we overcome those? And so we over-identify with that experience when we were young monastics and are not prepared to sort of grow and change to meet the challenges that lie ahead of us. And so this is where, you know, I can see in that generation of senior monastics that, you know, there are some who manage to do that. An obvious example being Ajahn Brahm, or another one being Bhikkhu Bodhi, for example, who have continued to develop and to change in their ideas and to grow and to expand. And of course this doesn't mean rejecting those experiences of youth. It doesn't mean that there was anything wrong with them. It just means that one needs to go beyond that. One needs to keep on growing. One needs to keep on building and moving in a spiritual sense. This is otherwise the vitality drops out. And so you can see if there's this kind of excessive reliance on tales from long ago, when I was a young monk stories, it's become fossilized. Those insights and achievements and accomplishments which were genuinely vital and relevant and meaningful at that time inevitably become fossilized relics because of just being retold so much. It's a memory of a past insight. It's not a record of something that's actually happening at the present time, so it doesn't have that vitality anymore. So these are just some thoughts and reflections on this notion of spiritual development, and just trying to put this in some kind of context. And of course I'm well aware that I've ignored many important and relevant factors here, but just trying to get it down to a few simple principles that I think are of some significance. So in any case, I offer this for your reflection this evening, and I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
Paripanna Bhagavato Sabhaka Sangho Sangham.